Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corlin Shad here, your host for the weekend edition, also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. It was another pretty busy week of interviews, kind of balanced out with a lot of market commentary and some company updates scattered throughout. On this weekend show, we're going to focus a lot on the resource sector, talk about some of the recent news that has come out of the sector, and also very much look at it from the general investing angle, especially carried over to the stocks, because I know that a lot of us, a lot of you follow these stocks, invest in the stocks, and well, broadly, we all hope that I think these stocks can start moving higher rather than this grinding downward trend that we have seen. That ties us into our first topic, and it also ties us into our first guest here, Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Matt, as I just mentioned, look, a lot of these stocks in the resource sector continue to struggle. A lot of the commodities, mostly range-bound, but in a broad sense, this, at least when it comes to the stocks, do you think that we are in a bear market, a longer-term bear market, or is this broadly just a painful correction that we're all seeing?
Well, good to be joining you, gentlemen. Good morning, and man, it has been absolutely brutal out there. You know, the MJG fund hung in there very well through much of the year. We were up a little bit over 16% through mid-year, which was the last performance update for our LPs. And through the end of July, we're neck and neck with the S&P. So I was quite pleased with performance over that period. But I must say the past 3.5 months have just been very, very painful. And I know any of us that are exposed to this space, absent maybe a pure uranium bulls, are feeling that pain as well. You know, anytime that you have a drawdown of this magnitude over a multi-month period, you know, it's worth examining one's assumptions. And I think it's a fair question to ask, you know, for commodities generally, are we in the midst of a bull market and experiencing a correction? Or could this be the start of a secular bear? You know, the likes that we saw between 2011 and 2015. It's not a pretty concept to envision, but I think it's important to keep oneself intellectually honest. So this has been something that I've been, you know, thinking about in recent weeks. But I land in the same place, as ugly as it is, particularly in the junior patch, but really across metals equities generally. I do feel strongly that this is a correction, and we remain in the midst of a multi-year commodity bull run, as hard as it may be for some of your listeners to believe. There are really four factors that lead me to this conclusion. The first you touched on already is metal prices. If you remember, going back to the depths of, you know, 2014, 2015, the depths of the last, you know, serious commodities bear market, we had gold in the toilet among, as well as the equities. So there was no differential there. In this environment, there's a huge disparity between physical metal prices and what we're seeing amongst the metal producers and then all the way down to the junior patch. I mean, heck, we have gold just 5% off of all-time highs. Back in 2014, 2015, it was almost 50% off all-time highs, you know, flirting with $1,000 per ounce. We have iron ore well north of $100 a ton. You know, these are not bear market prices by any means. We have copper hanging out pretty comfortably in the mid $3 range. You'll remember just 2.5 years ago in the midst of the COVID 2020 panic, we had copper, at least intraday, trade below $2 a pound. So from a metal price perspective, the metals are hanging in there quite well. And the signal they're sending is that this is not the beginning of a secular bear. Second point that comes to mind, and this is probably the most important of the bunch, is that we have yet to see a major CapEx boom in this cycle that would generally signify the top of a metal bull market run. You know, looking back over the past couple years, even as, you know, metals have gotten some increased attention in the post-COVID era, We're nowhere near the capital expenditure numbers and on a cumulative basis that we saw in 2011, 2012, and 2013. And I feel extremely confident that before this bull market has run its course, we will see annual CapEx spend within the sector at large well above figures that we saw at the peak of the last bull cycle. And again, these figures are below what we saw in 2011, 2012, and they're not even inflation adjusted. If you inflation adjust the figures we're seeing, we're still well off the highs. So we have not seen that major commitment to new mine builds and development that you'd expect to see towards the top of the cycle. And so that's a really key point for me. Another one that we've discussed on previous KE report appearances would be the relative valuation of the commodity space writ large relative to other asset classes. You'll remember during the last bull market cycle, the Chinese-driven commodity super cycle, that we saw commodity equities, including oil and gas, in this total, reaching up towards close to 30% of the weighted market cap of the S&P 500. We're nowhere near there in current terms. We're in the mid-single digits as it stands. So we're not seeing outsized weightings of commodity equities relative to other financial asset classes, not even close. And then the final point I'll add is the green energy push. I think this is a long-term tailwind for the space, and I believe it's more than just a narrative. Narratives are important as well, but we're seeing real action from Western governments, and that's a new phenomenon over the past 2.5 years. Tens of billions of dollars of financial support, at least being committed towards the space. We've yet to see much of that money flow, but if anything, that's a good thing. It's on its way, and at least some talk from regulators about tweaking things on the permitting side to make development stage projects be able to turn into mines more efficiently and in a more streamlined process. So really, for these four factors, I remain convinced that we're in the right space over the course of this decade. Of course, that doesn't mean that things can't get, more ugly in the immediate term here. But my confidence is unwavering in terms of where we are in the cycle.
Well, Matt, I definitely appreciate you sharing that big picture view of the commodity sector and some of the factors you're looking at. I especially like the point you made about how commodities are weighted and valued relative to other asset classes on a longer term chart, a big picture chart. There's still a lot of room for the commodity cycle to keep running. But I do have a question for you about how you as an investor kind of go after the commodity sector, because not all commodities move in tandem. Like, as we know, oil had a huge move last year, it's pulled back some, but when you look at oil equities and XLE, the biggest producers, and you look at a five-year chart, it's still up very high compared to a lot of the other commodity sector. You can make the same point with uranium, that URNM or URA are doing great compared to most commodities. Lithium had a big run a couple of years ago, but really the overall cycle peaked 2 years ago in 2021, and it's gradually pulling back. Still a lot better than the precious metals, though. And even the copper, you brought up copper, how it's had a range of, let's say, between $2 and $5. The copper producers, though, in COPEX, COPX, they're still doing relatively well if you look at a longer-term chart, even though they've rolled over some over the last year or so. So as an investor, do you try to look at which sectors are running? I know you don't like to look at just a metal-specific investment thesis. You look at a company-specific thesis. But when you're dissecting commodities, how do you go after where the growth stories are and where the sectors are that are cooling off?
Yeah, and I'll just harp on that point you mentioned towards the end of your question. And I think this is important for all investors in this space. If you want to speculate on metal prices, then buy the physical metal itself, or buy the major producer and hang up your boots. But that's not how we invest at MJG. Very much company specific focus in terms of our individual investments. And so I like to look at names, starting with the management team, moving to asset quality, looking at the company structure, looking at upcoming catalysts, looking at its price to value. Only at the very end of the investment process do I consider jurisdiction, and then very last, the commodity of focus. So I think it's very important, especially in the junior patch, not to get caught up in metal price narratives and instead focus on companies that, if things go to plan, can create value, even assuming flat metal prices for the foreseeable future. And then, of course, if metal prices work in your favor, then great. That's wind in your sails. With that said, taking a bigger step back, I think there's a few things to look at if you want to speculate on metal prices. One would just be to look at the cost curve and how much, you know, what percentage of producers are actually making money at current metal prices. And you'll remember for uranium back 4 or 5 years ago, we reached a time where maybe only a quarter of production was actually making money, where the rest of the space was either breaking even or losing money on production. Of course, that's not a telltale signal that things are going to turn immediately. But, you know, looking back 4 or 5 years from that point, uranium prices have done very well. So that's one indicator that investors can look at if they want to play the metal price, you know, speculation game. Another is to look at incentive pricing. For instance, copper trading at $3.50 a pound. Not terrible pricing, as you note, especially where we've been in recent years. With that said, for the next generation of copper mines, you know, mega porphyry deposits to come online, we're going to need at least $5 copper for these developers, sustainable $5 copper for these companies to push the go button on the next generation of deposits. And also, it's worth noting that these projects are so big, so technically difficult, so risky that even the largest copper miners globally can really only dedicate their resources to one mine build at any given time. So we're well off the levels that we need to see for copper producers to press go on the next generation of builds. And oftentimes you'll need to see the actual metal price well in excess of the incentive price. So incentive prices will say around $5.25, $5.50 copper in the current environment. There are scenarios where you don't see a major supply response until you see the metal price 2x the incentive price. So, you know, that's another figure to look for if you're trying to play the commodity price game.
So, Matt, you made a couple comments that I do want to touch back on, but one more so than anything is that the funding environment for green energy seems to be better, but not a whole lot of that money that governments have allocated has been put to use. But the funding environment for, let's say, precious metals, even into copper, it doesn't seem like there's a market there. Investors are not spending money. Companies are not raising money. Does this change anytime soon? Simply because this is a key aspect for companies to continue to advance projects.
That's right. Well, the government support has been slow moving because that's government for you. Governments are slow moving. But you're right. Across the metal complex, and again, going to the junior space, these companies have been forsaken, both on the retail side of things and in terms of larger companies stepping down. There are a few notable exceptions. Maybe we can touch on Hercules Silver and their deal with Barrick in a little bit. But I, at this point in the cycle, I was expecting significantly more support from the major mining companies coming downstream and providing capital for the next generation of discoveries and the higher quality development projects that, you know, have a stone's throw chance of making it into production during this cycle. We've really yet to see that in mass. I think that's coming. I'm very confident that's coming. So that's another tailwind that we have to look forward to in the coming years. But it's just not there at the moment. So there's a real gap in the market. You know, there are the royalty and streaming companies out there. They're providing capital, but a lot of juniors understandably are leery of taking on a royalty and encumbering their assets, or later stage development projects taking on a stream and encumbering their assets. I do think there is a niche for private equity here. You've seen Appian Capital be quite active here in recent months, and they've recently raised a $3 or $4 billion fund that is going to be deployed. So maybe we'll see royalty and streaming and private equity somewhat plug the gap in the immediate term here. But you're right, the support from, you know, traditional retail and the major miners is largely lacking. Yes, that's painful in the near term, but from a contrarian perspective, that's only going to lengthen out the duration of this bull market that I believe that we're still in. So it's a mixed bag.
Well, Matt, in lieu of all these macro forces that we see from the funding side, from, you know, shifting narratives on the commodities, from where the success is happening in the resource space, how has the MJG posture shifted since our last conversation as far as what are you looking at? What are you investing in? Have you made any big decisions in your fund? How have you allocated capital personally?
Yeah, good question. It's actually shifted quite markedly since our last conversation, which I believe was mid to late September. So I actually did envision pain in the junior mining space this year, which is why we didn't add a single new position to our portfolio. Believe it or not, between late January of this year all the way until early October. So we're talking nearly 9 months. That's by far the longest period that we've gone without adding a new position to the portfolio. We, of course, were dollar cost averaging into some positions, you know, trimming others, selling others outright. So I remained active over the period. We weren't deploying capital into new names. Additionally, and I've been quite vocal about it, you know, we're keeping a double-digit cash position. In hindsight, I wish it was closer to 30% than in the low teens, but at least keeping some powder dry for an envisioned pullback. But what I didn't envision was seeing the broader markets hang in there to the extent that they have, and yet the juniors suffering to their current extent. My concern throughout the entire year was broader cracks in the financial system and in other asset classes reflecting poorly on the juniors and creating a liquidity event. That has simply not happened. Broader markets have hung in there remarkably well, and yet the juniors have suffered. So, I got to a decision point, you know, late September, early October, where this drawdown had occurred amongst the juniors, and yet the broader market had not cracked. So it was a bit of a tough decision, but I've learned over the years that when sentiment is at rock bottom, as it is currently, and when prices are cheap and when opportunity is plentiful, even if it doesn't feel comfortable, it's worth plugging one's nose and deploying capital. So even though we have not seen the cracking of the broader markets, starting in early October, we deployed most of our dry powder. So we've done three separate deals between the first week of October and just last week. So that we've aggressively deployed just in the past 6 weeks here. You know, time will tell whether or not this was the right decision. It's quite possible that we jumped the gun and we see the broader market, you know, collapse next month. And in hindsight, it would have been better to keep that dry powder dry. But again, the opportunities that were crossing my desk were too good to pass up. We were in the depths of tax loss selling. And so, you know, I made the choice to get aggressive. And we're now, from a cash perspective, in the, you know, mid to low single digits as it stands. So from my perspective, that's a marked shift in posture from where we were just a few months ago.
All right, Matt. Well, since you're starting to deploy your capital, three deals since October, can you share with us any details on these deals that are getting you more active?
The money question there. I'm happy to share one of them. They were all initiated through private placements. The one that's probably most topical as it stands is Talisker Resources. That's a name that you're probably well familiar with their Brailorn mine in British Columbia. It's a name we've never owned. It's a name I've followed closely for a number of years. I have a lot of respect for their CEO, Terry Harbert, who's one of the better respected geologists globally, frankly, very, very solid guy. And I've watched the Talisker share price, unfortunately for existing shareholders, fall close to 85% between its highs in early 2021 to the level where they conducted their most recent placement in mid-October. The deal valuation there was 25 million Canadian. You know, Talisker itself in the past few years have put $50 million into the ground at their project. So you're getting it at 50 cents on the dollar from what they've spent. And that doesn't count the significant investment in infrastructure and drilling that had occurred at these series of assets before Talisker took the reins in the Brailorn district. And then additionally, another, data point from a valuation perspective. Talisker earlier this year struck a pretty interesting deal with Sprott Royalty and Lending, where they, in essence, sold up to a 4% royalty, which again is is a healthy royalty, no question, on Brailorn. But instead of selling it all at once, they have the option to draw down Sprott's money in tranches. So they've only drawn a couple tranches. The company's plan is to not draw down any more of that royalty to keep it at a more manageable level, closer to 2%. However, they have that in their back pocket. And were they to access all of that capital and go up to a 4% royalty tomorrow, that would bring in a cumulative $55 million into Talisker's bank account. So that's another data point relative to where the valuation of the deal took place. So we'll see. There's execution risk here. Talisker is going into production mid next year at their Mustang mine. They're fully financed for that, and I think if they're able to execute on that, they'll be well rewarded. So this is quite simply just a bet on quality people at a cheap valuation. And I think it's worth noting that Terry and the management team stepped up pretty big in the financing. And additionally, there was open market buying in the weeks before the financing for the first time in quite a while for the company. So it seemed like the right time to take a stab at this. And, you know, we'll learn more over the next 9 months of whether that was the right decision or not.
Matt, I appreciate you breaking down some of the thought process and the rationale behind your new position in Talisker. And I think it'd be fun to discuss something you brought up earlier in the call, and that's Hercules Silver, in the sense that it's a story that's really trending right now. It's a story getting traction with investors because of a new discovery that they have made underneath the silver deposit. And so Hercules Silver traded under the ticker BIG, but it's really gotten people's attention going because Barrick has come in as a partner. And when you see a major come in and vet a project, you know they probably have seen the drill core, and they put their stamp of approval on it. Not a huge position for Barrick, but meaningful for Hercules Silver. What's your take on, I guess, some of the only excitement that we're seeing in the resource sector right now?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, especially over the past 5 or 6 weeks, absent anything uranium-focused, this has been one of the few names that's actually been bringing joy to junior investors. And I should caveat it, we don't have any direct exposure to Hercules. But it's really exciting from my perspective for a few reasons. The first is that, I mean, this is what we love about the junior space. I understand it's extremely risky at this stage. I mean, we're talking a $300 million market cap as of this morning on the back of a single drill hole. But it's just amazing seeing a company go from a silver-focused junior to now, you know, having control of what's one of the most exciting copper discoveries in the world. So there's kind of the allure of value creation on the back of a single drill hole. And, you know, this exemplifies why we love this space. The other thing I find interesting about it, you know, it pertains to Idaho writ large. You know, conventional geological opinion here for many decades now is that Idaho is not a place to look for copper porphyries. It's been entirely written off. And anytime that you see conventional geological wisdom flipped on its head, I always find that to be kind of an interesting inflection point. And I think the Barrick investment validates, at the very least, that, you know, serious geologists think this could be real. And I know for sure that there's a staking rush going on in the immediate district where Hercules has made their discovery. I also think this could lead, and of course we'll see what the remaining drill holes bring, but this could lead to a larger staking rush across the state as prospectors and major companies, you know, really covering the full gamut, you know, re-examine this long-held opinion that Idaho is not a place to look for copper porphyries. So that's another angle that I find quite intriguing. You know, as you noted, Barrick put $24 million into Hercules at $1.10 per share. This would have been last Monday. They then, a few days later, followed on by buying $6.5 million worth of warrants from an existing Hercules shareholder. So Barrick has deployed, you know, $30 million. You know, for a $30 billion company, you're right. This is just a punt from their perspective. They have certainly not bet the farm on Hercules at this stage. But from Hercules' perspective, it's a good deal in most respects. They now have, you know, $24 million to work with. That's going to give them at least 12 months of runway to really hit this project hard. Additionally, they have the endorsement of, you know, one of the savvier major producers out there, led by Mark Bristow. I should note, you know, Bristow's putting his money where his mouth is as it comes to his love affair with copper porphyries. And, you know, one interesting aspect here, at least as of yet, there's no gold kicker that we've seen at the Hercules project. The byproducts are silver and moly. That, of course, could change elsewhere in the system, but as it stands, there's no gold to speak of. So even in the entire absence of gold, Bristow and the Barrick team are clearly very excited about what's going on here. I should just note, though, there were some strings attached to the deal. Barrick, in addition to its strategic investment, received information rights over the project, so they're now very plugged in to what's going on and know far more than the market at this point. And I also believe up to 3 Barrick geologists will be assigned to helping the Hercules team push this forward, which is an interesting note. But they have the information rights, they have anti-dilution rights, and most importantly, Barrick was able to secure a ROFR over the future sale of the project. And that's not insignificant. I've had very smart folks in my network say, well, that's it for Hercules. They've handed the keys to Barrick. There have been other folks in my network who have, you know, aptly pointed out, well, look at Turquoise Hill. It was a similar situation with Rio. And on the back of that discovery, it didn't stop Turquoise Hill share price from creating significant value in the immediate aftermath of the discovery there over a couple years. So I think the jury's still out in terms of how significant this ROFR turns out to be. It does set the bar higher for how special this discovery will have to be to create value from its current valuation. But if the rocks are special enough, you know, there's still room. There's still the potential for the share price to run. And, you know, we've seen the share price. I think we're up to all time highs as we speak right now. Share price up about 30% from the level at which Barrick put money into Hercules. So as of now, the market is overlooking the ROFR aspect.
Boy, oh boy, that stock has just taken off. And look, it's captured a lot of people's attention, rightfully so. Real quick, before we get you out of here, then, Matt, I want your comments on Calibre Mining taking over Marathon. So diversifying into Newfoundland at that Valentine Gold Project. That project still needs a lot of capital to be built. In about a year's time, they are estimating first gold to be poured in early 2025. What's your takeaway from, hey, some sort of M&A deal?
Hey, it's good to see. Yeah, we don't have a horse in the race with either of these names. I guess a few thoughts on the deal. The first is that this, given the timing, this seems to be a deal that was hatched at Beaver Creek. I don't know that for sure. But generally, from initial discussions, it will take 2-3 months, even up to 6 months, for a deal actually to come to fruition. So that's the general time frame that we're talking about here from the Beaver Creek conference in mid-September. Look, I mean, I have to hand it to Calibre. I think they've parlayed a really tough situation in Nicaragua. They have some, you know, decent assets down there that are cash flowing, but they saw the writing on the wall and have moved aggressively out of country to the point where now 60% of their NAV is split between Nevada and now Canada. So I think they've done well there. Of course, their first acquisition was Fiore Gold, Tim Worman's vehicle in the Pan mine in Nevada, and now the move for Marathon. You know, they have assumed some build risk, so they are taking on, you know, the risk of executing here technically and doing it on time and on budget. But they've done that at the expense of reducing their jurisdictional risk a little bit further here. So I think it's a neat deal. It's good to see a 26% premium. That's factoring in for the financing that Calibre's putting into Marathon. So I think this is a further indication that the era of no premium mergers has drawn to a close. You know, I'm not expecting a competing offer. I think it's within the realm of possibility. Maybe I'd handicap it at 20-25% that a bigger party steps in and makes a competing offer. I will say that the higher that the gold price goes before this deal closes, the more likely it is that somebody else steps in. But as of now, that's not my expectation. And I guess the final point I'd have for you is, you know, interesting read through here for later stage developers or even companies that are in the midst of a mine build. You would have seen that Artemis Gold, which is in the process of building its Blackwater project in BC, was up 6% on the day that the Marathon deal was announced. I've heard Skeena bandied about as a potential beneficiary of this deal, at least from a sentiment perspective. Talisker, as I mentioned, is a name that's going into smaller scale production, but going into production nonetheless. You know, even Osino Resources is a name that's come to mind for me. They're not North America based, I'll grant that, but they're reaching the stage where they're about to make the decision on whether to press go on a mine build there at their Twin Hills project in Namibia, or whether they hand off that project at a premium to a bigger party to take that forward. So it's good to see. There'd been a little bit of lull on the M&A front, but it seems like groups are coming back to the table as we lick our wounds in terms of what's occurred over the past 3 to 6 months.
All right, Matt, thank you very much for your insights and sharing some of what your fund has been doing, getting a bit more active in the space. I hope for your sake, I hope for all of our sakes that it is good timing and these stocks do start to get some traction and move higher alongside, especially the gold price, but even silver has started to move as well. So Matt, thank you for your time, everybody. Stick around. We are going to be right back chatting with Joe Mazumdar, continuing to focus on the resource space.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.